From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining after.
Coming up on Mouthful, a discussion with Joe Otis of Willowbrook Cellars and Olive Ridge Wines. Yes, that's right. And a return visit by Chef John Ash. We'll be launching a new conversation about what you eat here on Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. So stay tuned.
Well, you're shoving all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
Mashed potatoes, yeah.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most unpredictable hour. Wow! I have never been dumped out of a chair before. It's Michelle Jordan. Who else would it be? And that's just, like, really funny. And it's not Olive Ridge. It is Owl Ridge Wines and Willowbrook Cellars. Sorry about that, Joe.
Oh, no problem. No problem.
And you're just coming in from North Carolina?
Yeah, I flew in yesterday evening. So I was out there for a couple of weeks doing, what winemakers do, which is, part of our work, going out and having nice meals and chefs making delicious foods like you do, John. Mm-hmm. Basically having food paired with your wine and sort of going out there and giving a little bit of talk to them and sort of enjoying the lovely North Carolina environment. So.
And then, John, I want to bring you in right now, too, Chef John Ash, of course. And you wear lots of different hats. You are, of course, co-host of the Good Food Hour with Steve Garner and have been for a really long time.
Almost 20 years. Can you imagine that we've been on the radio?
That has to be really astonishing to you.
Well, it is astonishing, especially in radio, in commercial radio.
Yeah.
They all change so fast that KSRO has been sold, I think, during the time that we've been there, probably five times. Different companies have bought it. And we've always thought, we're going to be, going to go to country western or something like that. But luckily, we've kind of held in there. And it's a good thing, I think, in the sense that KSRO, in the same way that you do, really talks to kind of local issues, and the people are still interested.
Yeah, I think it's really great. It's the longest running food and wine show in, I think, all of California. Yeah, or at least Northern California, for sure.
Actually, it is west of west of the Mississippi, but we're not sure.
Well, excellent. Congratulations. Yeah, and then, of course, there's John Ash and Company, the restaurant that bears your name. But you now you're not exactly a winemaker, but you have a wine company.
I do. Yeah, there are four of us who are involved in this thing called the Sauvignon Republic.
Taking over the world, one bottle at a time.
That's right. We're the Republic of Sauvignon. Don't screw with us, that. And our focus is, and it's been a really interesting project. We make Sauvignon Blanc only, and we go to those places in the world that really produce wonderful Sauvignon Blanc. And people have asked me, well, why just Sauvignon Blanc? And as a cook, I will tell you, and I mean, it's been a funny question. I've I've been asked, well, if you were to drink one wine varietal for the rest of your life, what would it be? And for me, it's always been Sauvignon Blanc. And my little connection there is Sauvignon Blanc, when it's made, I think, as it should be made, it's fresh, it's clean, it's citrusy, lemony. It's like a squeeze of lemon. And I think all foods, whether they are sweet or savory, can be improved by a squeeze of lemon. And so that's my great love of Sauvignon Blanc. And we have three of them now, one from Russian River here in Sonoma County, one from the Stellenbosch in South Africa, one from Marlborough in New Zealand. And next year we'll add Friuli in Italy to the mix.
And when will you be adding Sancerre?
Sancerre after that. It's been interesting. We thought we were going to Sancerre before then. But I will, which I know you'll appreciate, you know, in dealing, we have some wonderful French friends, but they sort of look at us as only the French could do.
Yep.
And they say to us, well, why would you make Sauvignon Blanc any other place than France? And so it's been a little more difficult to convince them to join up with us.
Well, I'm looking forward to that one. Given a choice, it would come down immediately for me to two varietals. If I had to choose just one, it would be really hard. And it would be either Sauvignon Blanc or the wine that really has my heart, and that is Pinot Noir. Mm. And that is part of the reason that you're here, Joe. I think it must have been the 2004 vintage.
Yeah, I think what you experienced was our Dutton Ranch Morelli Lane Pinot, which is pretty interesting. In 2004, we actually did two different Pinot Noirs. The vineyards where we sourced the fruit from were only a couple miles apart from one another. And I actually brought them here tonight. What's interesting about them is they actually focus on different clones, even though the vineyards are actually rather close together. With Pinot Noir, clone is, you know, very important. So we have our estate vineyard, which is a combination of Dijon clones, which from the Russian River Valley you get a lot more of that cola, coffee bean, black cherry fruit. And the one that you experienced was our Dutton Ranch Morelli Lane Pinot, which is closer towards Occidental up on the hills there. And that's 100% Pommard clone, where you get a lot of that brown spice, bright red fruit, that kind of brambly red fruits to it, which is a really, really pleasant wine. So that's gone over, both of them have gone over very well, but very different styles. It's always kind of a coin toss between which one someone prefers.
So that Morelli Lane one is 100% Pommard?
It's 100% Pommard.
Now, seems less common these days. It seems like you're usually getting a mix of various clones in most vineyards.
Yes, yes. And the vineyard itself is actually a combination of numerous clones. The first year that we dealt with the Morelli Lane was in 2003, and we just liked what we got so much from that vineyard that we set up a per-acre contract and took the whole Pommard section from them. So then they went out and they would micromanage it according to whatever specifications I gave them, and we just took those few acres in that of Pommard and just did 100% Pommard clone. It's turned out very nicely.
Well, anytime you feel like it, you can open whichever one you think we should taste first while we talk. And I'd like to know a little bit about how you got started with Pinot Noir. What attracted you to this particular varietal?
Oh, it has everything to do with the challenge.
Okay.
It was one of those things that, I started in the wine industry when I was rather young. I think it was about a month after my 21st birthday. And to be quite honest, I was not a Pinot Noir fan. But I was working at Ravenswood. And one of the older gentlemen there who basically told me to, saw that I had a passion in wine and saw I had a good palate, said, you know what, we're going to go out wine tasting today and I'm going to introduce you to what good Pinot Noir is all about. And after that day, it kind of opened my eyes and I developed this huge passion for Pinot Noir and basically wanted to see what was going on out there. So I spent a lot of time visiting high-end Pinot Noir producers and just talking to them, seeing what they do and seeing all the different approaches with it. And it's you know, it's a really fascinating grape to deal with. And, you know, I feel somewhat fortunate because at our facility, we actually make wine at the Owl Ridge Wine Services that my business partner owns. We make wine for 31 different clients there. So I'm dealing with some of the best Pinot Noir winemakers around in the area are making their Pinot Noir at our facility. So, you know, I see what Greg LaFollette's doing, what James McVale is doing, what Scott Rich is doing with Talisman, or Scott Covington used to be part of Olivet Lane, and I get to see what works for these different people and sort of, you know, sort of see what works, what I like, what what would be something I could definitely deal with. So it's kind of
so Olive Ridge is in part a custom crushing facility.
Yeah, there's Owl Ridge wines, which I make also, but those are predominantly Cabernet. The Willowbrook label is where we do a lot of Pinot Noir, but Owl Ridge Wine Services, we actually make wine for, as I mentioned, 30-some different clients, and it's really focusing on producing high-end Pinot Noir. So we make Pinot Noir for numerous Russian River sources out there. Some of the best Pinot Noirs coming out of the Russian River are made at our facility.
And where is it located?
We're located in the old VacuDry building on Occidental Road and Gravenstein Highway. So we're and it's pretty amazing because even just within our little complex, we're surrounded by, you know, some other really prestigious Pinot Noir producers. So we're kind of in good company
there. It's really become an amazing little artisan community there. I mean,
it is
wine people, but cheese people, and
we have the little goat cheese people there, it's really booming. Yeah.
And it's really great to see that facility being used. It was so sad when it closed. So that's really nice. Well, open a bottle.
Oh yes.
Atta girl.
Yes.
Yes.
Gotta keep things on track here.
Okay, let's have a little bit of this Dutton Ranch Pinot Noir.
So, would you talk a little bit about? It's always fascinating because for people who don't know about Pinot Noir, I mean, its reputation is the most difficult grape to grow, the most difficult grape to turn into wine. Why is that?
Well, it is something that, you know, has a lot to do with where the vineyards are sourced from and where it's the vineyards that you are dealing with. And you do have to keep the yields rather low. So, you know, a lot of effort has to be put into the vineyard. And winemaking, from a winemaking point of view, it's probably not a good thing to say, but I like to compare it to beer because I did brew beer at one point. When you have something that is lighter flavored, like your lighter flavored beers or your lighter flavored wines, any slight defect is going to be more and more noticeable to it. Well, if you have like a real strong porter, a real strong stout, you can have basically a slight screw up, but the flavors are so intense, it's going to kind of cover that up. If you get a big, robust Zinfandel, you can get away with a lot, while with a more delicate Pinot Noir, one little thing is going to really stand out.
So what about this idea? I'm going to jump in.
I'm so happy.
Well, because before we were on the air, we were talking about this whole idea of styles of Pinot Noir, and there seems to be this style, which is big. Well, you described it, Michelle, as Syrah-like.
Yeah. Over-extracted, dark. Which darkness is not a traditional quality, a traditional attribute of Pinot Noir. But there have been winemakers boasting about their mission is to, they call it the cabernization of Pinot Noir. And they're going after both the high marks from certain wine critics and going after the people who spend a lot of money on Cabernets, big Cabernets. Where do you come in on this whole thing?
Well, my personal point of view is I'd like to have Pinot Noir have a little more acidity than what you would see is kind of becoming the more and more fad of being more Syrah-like, especially where you kind of over-extract and really get a lot of this kind of a hard phenolic character where you get a lot of that real strong coffee bean chocolate character where you're really extracting as much from the skin as possible and you lose some of that fruit and you get those non-fruit flavors really showing up. And then you basically lose that little bit of acidity and it sort of becomes rich and round. And I think it really loses a lot of its varietal character that way. So
there's this thing that I look for in Pinot Noir. And I don't know what it is. I don't know how to describe it. I call it the Pinot thing. I call it the Pinot thing, and this wine has it.
Okay.
And it's in the nose, it's in the bouquet, it translates to the palate in certain very ephemeral ways. If it is there, you know for certain it's Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
It's the most lovely, seductive, ephemeral, beautiful quality of Pinot Noir, and over-extraction kills it.
Yes.
It's not there in the bigger Pinots. And that's so sad. It's just such, there's no other wine that has that little particular thing.
Yeah.
And it's that heartbreakingly delicate beauty. And I hate to see Pinots that have lost that.
Well, I mean, again, it's kind of hard to know exactly what character you're talking about. But with this particular Pinot, it does have like a nice little.
I think I do. What I get in here is that it's a interesting kind of floral quality, almost violets, you know, is one of the flavors.
Violets, kind of like a damp forest floral character to it, which you,
And that's
something,
not a fruit bomb.
Yeah, yeah, and that's something that I definitely notice more with the Pommard clone than I do with Dijon clones. Dijons, you get a lot more of that kind of cola, chocolatey, kind of coffee bean character. So it seems to go more towards those darker tones, while Pommard's always really light and bright and just a really pleasant
that
style of wine.
Is so nice.
And that's something that, you know, for the Pinot Noirs that I was introduced to and stuff like that, that's sort of what I'm looking for, is that kind of little bit of like a forest floor character
to
it.
So can we talk for just a second about kind of what's happened with Pinot Noir pricing-wise and all of that? I mean, it's something that I know Michelle and I talked about in a broader sense about it's become this darling of collectors, and as a result, it's so expensive that the common man can't afford to buy great Pinot Noir anymore.
It is very unfortunate.
Yeah, absolutely,
and,
right.
You know, as basically it is a very difficult grape to make, because you are dealing with vineyards where you are going to have to keep the yields under 3 tons an acre if you are going for high quality fruit. Well, if you grow, you know, Cabernet, Zinfandel, something like that, you can get up towards, around 6 tons an acre and still have a premium grape. With Pinot Noir, you really need to keep the yields rather low. So you're looking at a minimum of $3,500 to $5,000 a ton for good Pinot Noir grapes and coming out of this area. And it is so specialized that you can't get, you know, good Pinot Noir coming from the Lodi area or something like that to sort of keep the prices down. And on top of it, Pinot Noir seems to really absorb, and this high-end Pinot Noir seem to really love a lot of new high-quality French oak. I mean, with this Pinot Noir, even though you don't taste a lot of oak in it, it's 70% new oak, and you're looking at each barrel running, you know, $800 plus. Because the oak I'm using is very subtle flavored, it just gives a lot of richness and sort of frames the fruit instead of adding a dominant flavor component to it in itself. So it's just a very expensive wine to make if you're going to make it in that sort of high-end category.
And currently, there, because of its surge in popularity, currently the demand is there. Looking ahead, if we can, 2 or 3 years, do you think that this is going to continue? There's a lot of Pinot that's been planted, a lot that's going to be coming on. Do you think that the prices are going to stabilize at that high level?
Well, I think if you're dealing with a high-end vineyard and you're in a very unique area and you do produce high quality and kind of interesting fruit, you're always going to demand that high-end price. I think with time, with some of these vineyards that are a little bit more in this kind of solid Russian River category, the prices hopefully will go down. I'm praying for it. Because, you know, I actually do want to produce under the Willowbrook label a nice, reasonably priced Pinot that people can enjoy, but also still to be varietally correct.
Correct. And for some reason, a lot of the really inexpensive Pinots, they taste like cooked raisins.
Yeah.
And it would be really nice. I would like a $7.99 Pinot that tasted like a Pinot, modest, but something you can have a couple glasses with with dinner every night, and not feel that, you know, you're drinking your kids' education or your vacations for the next 10 years.
Yeah, it is. It is quite a challenge, actually. Just looking for, you know, reasonably priced Pinot. I mean, this past year I got some Pinot that was $3,000 a ton, and my business partner and I thought that was, you know, cheap. So,
good grapes.
It was actually amazing grapes. Yeah. I think that's one of the main reasons why you do see some of these high-end Russian River producers looking outside of Sonoma County for high-quality fruit. People going down to Marin County or Mendocino or Humboldt County trying to find some really outstanding vineyards out in that area. But with very
similar... As far north as Humboldt?
If you can find them.
Uh-oh.
If you can find
climate
them.
Climate change.
Yeah, it is. No, the few...
Yes, I love this Alaskan Pinot Noir. It's so wonderful.
No, the few Humboldt Pinots I've had are actually... they remind me a little bit more Oregonian in style than what you expect from the Russian River. But really, very, again, nice. But you're only looking at about probably 40 acres planted up there. And like down in Marin County right now, they only have about 85 to 90 acres
now, planted. Where is the Marin County Pinot? Is that on Chileno Valley Road?
There is quite a few off Chileno Valley Road, and to be quite honest, I actually expanded down there this year and got some, off the Cordis Ranch, which off in that area. Mark Pasternak's a very well-known vineyard manager down there who's kind of, I think, of the 60 acres of grapes planted down, or the 90 acres of grapes planted in that area, he's managing 60 of them. His vineyard, Devil's Gulch, has been doing very well under the Dutton Goldfield label, and Sean Thackeray's been running with it for a long time. So he's kind of like the guru of Marin County Pinot. So he's been doing very well. And I was very fortunate to sort of get in there kind of at the starting time. So I'm really excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we're going to take a little musical break and be right back with more talk here on Mouthful. You are listening to Mouthful on KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County. My guests this evening, Chef John Ash and Joel Otis of Joe Otis. I just can't seem to get 100% right tonight. Owl Ridge Wines and Willowbrook Cellars. We are drinking the 2004 Dutton Morelli Vineyard. Is that right?
Yes.
It's absolutely lovely. I'm going to assume it's sold out. Am I right? Or is
it still
out there?
No, actually, we just released it.
Oh, you just released it.
Well, not just released it. We released it about 6 months ago.
What's it sell for?
The suggested retail is $42. Mm-hmm. Again, going to the nice price point there. But it did very well in the Harvest Fair. We did take gold on this item. So, you know, the people who do carry the Harvest Fair gold locally, you can definitely find it there. Mm-hmm. You know, your Oliver's Markets and things
and do
like
you,
that.
Do sales through your website?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and what is the website?
Well, there's willowbrooksellers.com.
Okay, willowbrooksellers.com. And we will try to remember to repeat that at the end of the show, as we always do in Mouthful. So get your pen and paper. Mm-hmm. What else do you have over there for us to try?
What I thought would be interesting is to compare this 04 Dutton Ranch Pinot with our 04 Estate Grown Pinot, because you do have, you know, just a comparison of clones there, of looking at, you know, Pommard versus Dijon clones.
Right.
Just how the flavors will change, the aromatics will change. And these two vineyards are only about 4 to 5 miles apart from each other. But you are looking at elevation differences, climate differences, and, of course, clonal differences, as I was mentioning earlier.
Yeah, and remind us, what sort of growing season was 2004?
2004 was actually a moderate summer, but right before harvest, we had about 3 weeks straight of it being between 100 and 110 degrees. So very, very warm
climate.
That's
right. That was the weird fall from hell.
Yes, we had fruit coming in because of our custom crush business of every Pinot Noir coming from, we're talking out towards Bodega Bay and Fort Ross versus Vanderkamp up on the Sonoma Mountain, was all coming in within about a 10-day period. So we had almost our whole harvest done in about a 10-day time.
That's like working some 24 hours.
Exactly. It was really quite a hectic year for us. So.
Okay, and so now this one is further inland and lower inland.
This one is closer to Forestville. It's actually, there's a little hillside right outside the high school of Forestville. And this vineyard's right up
exactly
on top of it,
is.
Right off Anderson Road there in Covey. Mm-hmm. And this vineyard's right on top of it. While the Morelli Lane is right up off Harris Grade above Occidental. So, but you should get definitely a little bit of that kind of darker, smokier, kind of cola, coffee bean tones to it.
But with a very delicate texture.
Mm-hmm.
Long tannins.
Yeah, I mean, for me, balance is important, and I think style-wise, you'll notice like the pinots that I make do have a little bit more acid to them, so that they do pair a little bit better with food than what you're starting to see a little bit more and more kind of commonplace in the market. So.
Where are you when it comes to alcohol levels?
Moderate.
Moderate. I mean, what do you have an opinion about? I mean, because that's another thing that we're seeing is some really high alcohol levels.
Mm-hmm. And that's just what they're putting on the label, too.
Exactly.
I like to keep I really, you know, push to keep the wines in balance. Mm-hmm. It is definitely a tough thing, especially when you do have a year like in 2004 with all this heat where you're going to get incredibly high sugars coming in. It is kind of a coin toss there as to how do you approach to keep those sugars in balance and how to keep them lower so you do have a moderate alcohol without diluting the flavors of the wine.
Now, do you do any sort of interventions to lower the alcohol if you need to, which is fine? We've talked about that before on Mouthful.
Yeah.
There's the spinning method.
Well, that's removing alcohol when you get it, but... this is something that, you know, when I was at Ravenswood making Zinfandel, and you do have to use a lot of water to sort of dilute the sugars down at that point. And especially in a year when 04, what you're getting is basically just due to the intense heat, a lot of the water is evaporating out. So in order to get the flavor development that you want, you might have incredibly high sugars. So what you need to do is kind of add the water back to it, kind of an acidified water at that point. So you're kind of rehydrating the grapes as they come in, which is not something most people talk about. So.
I was going to say, people don't talk about that.
No. We don't really talk about it. But here I just did. So yeah, we'll see.
But with Zinfandel, it's a whole different thing because it's an uneven ripener.
It is an uneven ripener, right, and you're going to get consistently each year a lot more dimpling. Well, in 2004, there was a lot of dimpling in the fruit because of that intense heat.
Yeah, and it does make sense. Of course, any moisture evaporates when you're starting to get up into those temperatures.
Well, and the vines basically shut down when it exceeds, I think it's around 92, 93 degrees.
Gee, that's just like me.
So that's, I hear you on that. So basically, we were having so many of these days where it was 100 plus, the vines are shutting down, and that fruit is just sitting in the sun, dehydrating. And it was one of those tough decisions. Do you pick it according to the sugar, or do you pick it according to flavor development? So you can have high sugar underripe grapes.
Right.
Or you can have even higher sugar ripe flavored grapes.
Yeah, and that brings up a really interesting question. So, when the grapes come in, I mean, it always used to be sugar was the only determinant of. So how do you, can you talk a little bit more about how you, when you're looking for this flavor, what are you looking for?
Well, to be quite honest, the first couple of years I was out there and I was measuring sugars and I was looking at pH and acidity and stuff. When I go through vineyards now, I don't even measure sugars. Mm. I go through there, I taste the grape, I chew on the skins, chew on the seeds. The seeds will turn from green to brown and you'll see the development of the seed coloring as the grape becomes more and more mature. When it is a fully ripe and developed grape, and there's certain things like you'd expect from ripe fruit. The grape will fall off easily from the stem. The seeds will be brown. The skins should be soft and, you know, flavorful without having any, you know, off flavors to it. The tannins should be well developed. And these are just things that you look for. And, you know, in California, I'd say that is California's biggest challenge is the heat and the dry is actually, unlike many places in the world where they have a hard time getting reasonable sugars, California has no problem getting sugars. We get incredible sugars, but it is very difficult to get the flavor development while keeping the sugars in balance. So it is definitely a challenge.
What was your first vintage of Pinot?
I started in 2001. That's when I started the Willowbrook label. At the ripe old age of, I think I was about 27 then. I was 26 when I first came in. So.
And tell us the story of the name Willowbrook.
Oh, there's so many connections because it's one of those things that ended up, I found out so much more about the name after I came up with the name. But the initial reason for the name is I had a pet cockatoo that was named Willow. My business partner had a pet cocker spaniel named Brooke.
That is entirely too cute.
And that's where the name came from. It was a long drive up from L.A. and we're sort of brainstorming about names. And I was like, okay, so we came up with this. But looking back at it, you know, there's the Willowbrook Down in between Pingrove and Cotati in that area there. Mm-hmm. And when I first moved up here in 95, I actually lived right off that area. Mm-hmm. And then I found out from my father that there's this lovely community in between Watts and Compton down in L.A. that my grandmother lived in that was called Willowbrook. And we actually sell a couple
cases. That your grandmother lived in?
Yeah. And that every year the Willowbrook Fire Department in between Watts and Compton will call us up and order a couple cases of wine for their Christmas bash. So we have to give them a little bit of Willowbrook Cellars for that.
And you know, it's interesting. Do you know about the connections Joel Peterson has with the name Ravenswood?
Yes.
It's so remarkable. I was at Yosemite, and we're going to, hopefully, fingers crossed, the recording turned out well, but Joel gave this marvelous talk at the Yosemite Vintners Holiday in early December, and he tells the story that the first place that Zinfandel was made in America, it's this place, I think it's on Long Island, mm-hmm. Queens, I think, and it became for a brief time a high-end housing community, and it was named Ravenswood.
Yeah.
And he found this out long, long, long after he had named his winery Ravenswood.
Yeah.
It's like, how can things like that happen? It's like magic.
Yeah, it's just really interesting on how many all these things sort of filled into place when I looked back at the name Willowbrook and where it originally came from, what my original motivation was mm-hmm. for the name and inspiration was for the name and how it kind of tied in with, you know, family heritage mm-hmm. and moving up here and everything like that. So it is rather, you know, looking back at it is really kind of odd.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting. John, tell us about the birth of the name Sauvignon Republic.
What we were trying to do was to talk to this search of the world for.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sort of very vivid. It just yes, words together. So
yeah,
it seems sort of obvious.
Yeah, we were gonna originally among the other names we were thinking of was the Sauvignon Nation, but who was that awful guy who was on radio? On commercial radio the. Oh gosh, his name went out of my mind. Who got canned because he was so right wing and all
like
of that.
Savage?
The Savage Nation.
Oh
yes.
Oh, right.
Michael
okay.
Savage.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you. And we thought, that's probably not. That doesn't bode well. But it was really that idea that we were looking to really create, if you will, and to the extent that you're talking about what the French call terroir, that idea of the expression of these different places, mm-hmm. our whole approach is not unlike yours. It's even though we're doing it on a world basis, same winemaker, same winemaking regimen. We go to each of these
places.
I must
say I have been fortunate enough to actually taste your Sauvignon Blanc, so I'm actually quite a big fan.
Thanks,
so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating that mm-hmm. keeping all things the same as much as you can, they are so completely different from each other.
Oh, definitely.
Utterly different.
Because of where they come from. And one of the concerns, actually, I did an interview recently with Bill Daly, who's the food and wine writer for the Chicago Times. Tribune. For the Chicago Tribune. And I don't think he believes this, but what he threw to me was this question about in the wine world, you know, there's this vision that all wines, you know, like Chardonnay, for example, whether it comes from France or from California or Australia, mm-hmm. and probably this is the big boys talking about that it should all taste the same. You know, that there's a global flavor for each of these grape varieties.
First I've heard of that.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, if you taste inexpensive wines from large global producers, okay. And more it's happening this way, the
this
tendency is for them to make the flavor profile of the wine very much the same, which I think is just, and it's one of these kinds of insidious trends mm-hmm. that actually is a little frightening.
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
When you taste Chardonnay from France, for mm-hmm. example, and this is not to put down that style of Chardonnay, but it's interesting that it's tasting more and more like California or Australia.
Australia, a little bit more oak, a little less of that kind of musty, intriguing character to it.
Less acidity, mm-hmm. kind of sweeter and all of that
really,
stuff.
Really, the French Chardonnays are getting flabby?
Not the great white Burgundies, but if you look at Chardonnay from, you know, Chardonnay being kind of the queen of white wine grapes from Italy and from the Languedoc in France. And it, you know, if you taste it blind, you can't tell where it comes from anymore.
Yeah, so. Things have definitely changed quite a bit there.
And Pinot Noir seems immune to that somehow, at least so far.
Well, I mean, people who follow Pinot Noir, they sort of expect different flavor profiles of California Pinot Noirs versus Oregonian Pinot Noirs versus Burgundies, or if you have the opportunity to taste New Zealand Pinot Noirs, which I haven't quite made a strong push in the United States, but are coming.
Yeah,
they are coming.
They're delicious.
They are coming, but a very different flavor.
I've only had the chance to taste one or two. I'm really curious about them.
Yeah, and I mean, they will definitely be coming, so I mean, yeah, each one has its own unique character. I mean, Pinot Noir just is an odd grape, and it does change rather dramatically flavor profile, not just from clone to clone and growing region to growing region, but also from year to year. I mean, for that reason, that's why I did bring kind of a sample bottle of our 05 Pinot Noir, because you're looking at two extremely different climate years.
Yes, I've actually emptied my glass so that 05, we can compare and contrast.
I mean, in 05, we very rarely had a day over 85 degrees, so you're looking at it. 04, where you had day after day of it being 100 plus degrees, and in 05, where it was just a very long, mild growing season where harvest didn't even start until, you know, early to mid-October, which for Pinot Noir is about a good 4 to 5 weeks later than normal.
But big boy reds like Cabernet and stuff, you don't – I mean, there's some differences for sure, but you don't get these dramatic
changes. Yeah. And with this wine, you'll notice rather dramatic change from one year to the other.
And which vineyard is this?
This is 2005.
But which, I'm sorry,
this
which
is
vineyard?
Our estate.
Oh, this
so
is
the last
estate.
One you just had.
Like the last one, yes.
The last one you just had. So here you could just get a really see just the difference in flavors
very
from
different.
Vintage. Yeah.
Very different.
You know, not as much of the red fruit. You should get a little bit of the darker fruits.
Darker just due to that there's some rhubarb in there.
Yeah, a little bit. It's just a completely different
wine, very different.
Even though you're dealing with the exact same grapes, exact same vineyard, exact same oak profile, but just the change in vintage and just what the growing season offered to this particular wine. And it's basically the same treatment. So it is... It is rather different. So.
Interesting. You are listening to Mouthful. It is KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County and beyond if you're listening on the web. It's Mouthful. Thanks for sticking with us. I'm Michelle Jordan. We'll be here for another, 16-17 minutes or so. And we're going to take an abrupt shift in the conversation right now, but I'm inviting both of my guests, Joe Otis of Owl Ridge Wines and Willowbrook Cellars, and John Ash, are both going to participate in this. John, in particular, I asked to launch this conversation, and I'm hoping... If not tonight, sometime soon, we're going to come up with a name, John, for these conversations, because I want them to continue. And
I've got an idea.
Excellent.
We should call them salons. That's a
salon. Salon is such a lovely word.
It is.
Mouthful salon.
Yeah. Because it was a tradition for those who don't know what salons were. They were actually goes way back in time of sitting around and taking a topic and really in a conversational way exploring the good, the bad, the ugly, you know.
And salons have become very popular. Mm-hmm. There's been a salon, Livewire Salon, that took place down in Petaluma at Zebulon's for a long time, and Zebulon's sold, and they're looking for a new home right now. There was another place, I'm not going to remember the name of the restaurant, but it's in downtown Oakland about 10 years ago, and it hosted salons. And sometimes they're readings on topics. Mm-hmm. Seaweed Cafe out in Bodega, during the winter, they host salons once a month. So I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the Mouthful Salon.
Mouthful Salon. Yeah. And you are invited to become involved. And we're not going to do it by phone or by instant email. What we're going to do is open up the topic, and I'm going to give you my email address. It is catsmilk@sonic.net. And Mouthful, of course, we broadcast live, but only within, you know, a portion of Sonoma County on Sunday nights, tonight, you know, 7 to 8. However, on Wednesdays at 4 o'clock, Mouthful is posted on the NPR website and shortly thereafter becomes available through iTunes and also Yahoo, as well as NPR. We have listeners in Israel, Australia, New Zealand, Brooklyn, New York. So we do have listeners. We're branching out, and we've done this so far with no promotion. And so what I'm hoping is we get a whole global conversation going on. And the general theme really is, who is food for? And this was launched, or at least, you know, sort of given tangible expression at the most recent contest KGO did, which is a contest for stuffing. And John, you expressed
KSRO.
To me...
KSRO.
KSRO.
Yeah.
What did I say?
KGO.
Oh, KSRO. I'm going to slap my face.
There are big rivals.
KSRO.
Yeah.
And Olive Ridge.
Right.
Just have to... It's been a very difficult start to 2007 for me. Yeah. Things have been, you know, they've gone off track several times in 14 days. Anyway, we're talking about who are heirloom foods for? You know, sort of this concern that this really bountiful harvest of fine foods, organic foods, foods produced really as they have been throughout history, are suddenly available only to the wealthy, only to the well-to-do. And that's sort of the leaping off point for the conversation. Mm-hmm. And there are several people I know. This is something that Lou Preston of Preston of Dry Creek is very interested in. Deborah Walton of Canvas Ranch is very interested. And I suspect lots of people everywhere. John, and I are going to start it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think we had a previous brief conversation about this. And the fascinating thing is, and I guess I should set the stage here a little bit, because in Northern California, where we're at, we're blessed with a rich agricultural history and great diversity and all of that stuff. But one of the, and I think I can say that, well, I should say it for me, and maybe I can say it for you too, a kind of troubling thing that we see is that as we look at the larder of things in our pantry and from our gardens, there's been this tremendous interest in recapturing and keeping alive heirloom varieties of all kinds of things, plants and animals and all of that stuff. But in the process, as those things have become more available, not all of them, some of them have become readily available. I mean, I'm so excited that stores like Walmart, for goodness sake, this last summer had heirloom tomatoes that they were selling.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not a lot, but they had some there that, you know, regular supermarkets now are stocking these things rather than the god-awful things that they typically stock before. But there's this larger kind of ominous thing that that I kind of see out there of precious foods, I guess is my way of kind of describing it, in which... I have kind of mixed feelings about what's happened with slow food, and I think for those who don't know about slow food, and a wonderful organization, it's history, an amazing man named Carlo Petrini back in, I think, 1985, when McDonald's announced that they were going to build an outlet near the Spanish Steps in Rome, was completely
outraged
and sort of said, this is the death of food as we've known it. And so started a group, rather than calling it something Italian, called it slow food as opposed to fast food. And it was this idea of honoring the great traditions of food and the people who made great food and really trying to keep it alive for the next generation and for our children. All very admirable and wonderful things, and they've done great work. They have a project called The Ark, in which they honor those things that are in danger of disappearing and kind of put it on the Ark, like Noah's Ark, to try to keep it alive and introduce it to other people in the world and all of that stuff. So it's all really great stuff. I mean, they're to be lauded for that. But around the world, there are, gosh, I don't know, several hundred chapters, convivia, they call them now. And I can say that, and we both know, we've had a chance to attend a lot of slow food events that convivia have put on. And more what I'm kind of seeing is that it's the haves rather than the have-nots who are there celebrating, you know, their latest find of some special little grower, absolutely, producer or something like that. And it's almost like I've got it and you don't. So that the I describe them as, you know, the great unwashed, I guess, for any other sort of title. Me, all of the people that are on the streets are not. These products are just not available to them, and they're not available to them partly from supply, but they're not available to them also because of price.
They're not available to them because of price, and also to some degree the dissemination of the knowledge, and something to do with the way we have to spend our time and leisure. And one of my problems with, and I don't want to beat up on slow food, add several other, you know, avenues, is there seems to be time involved. And the majority of people on the planet today, as always, are really involved with day-to-day necessities. We have to feed our families. We have to get our sons and daughters to school. We have to go to work. We have to come home. We have things we have to do. We have to pay the bills. We have to put enough to eat on the table. And one of the insidious things, it seems to me, that has happened is the companies that are making that possible are agribusiness. They are often foods that have been stripped of nutrition, often foods that are based on huge corporate profit down the line, so that, you know, little Lucas eating whatever he's eating for dinner has absolutely no connection and may not be getting, you know, the micronutrients and all the nutrients that he needs. And there are people who have leisure and time to go to the farmer's market, to drive to the farm stand, to know the farmer, who are eating foods that 100 years ago our grandparents were sustaining themselves on. And the disturbing thing to me about that is it makes me feel like the world is broken in a very serious way. And I can go from there to Iraq. And how do people in Iraq shop? And I know a fair amount about Middle Eastern food and going to the market every day and the things that they need. And suddenly there's war, and there's, you know, if you go to the market, you might be blown up by a suicide bomber. And what does this mean about their next generation? And, you know, partly this is, anyone who listens to Mouthful, send us your thoughts about this. Yeah, get involved in the conversation.
I think it's a really interesting thing. One of the things, and we were, you know, and I don't mean to pick on Russian River Pinot Noir as a part of that, but there is this. I think it's my belief, and maybe it's just because I'm getting older, you know, that there needs to be much more of a kind of ecumenical approach to food. That I was just in, I think I relayed this story to you, and I don't know whether anybody will find it interesting, but I just returned from New York and had a chance to have dinner with Arthur Schwartz. And for anyone who doesn't know about Arthur Schwartz, he's quite an amazing man.
Force of nature.
And had had a show on WOR, really a very popular food show for a number of years. And he his touchstone for looking at maybe how the food universe should operate, he's a great student of Italy, and especially of southern Italy, is that there, this whole idea of what's precious and what's not precious and what's in and what's not in and all of that stuff just doesn't exist. That people have a very grounded sense of eating well, of being very connected to their local agriculture, of understanding and enjoying food on a broad scale, whether you're rich or poor. And I think one of the things that disturbs me about what we see happening here is that the manifestation of eating well and eating as an activity that kind of broadens your horizons and all of that is very much the widening gap between the haves mm-hmm. and the have-nots. And so the challenge, and so I would throw this out as a challenge to us, which I think is something we can do locally, but to us all is, no. Let's make it more ecumenical. Let's mm-hmm. come to the table and share, not because I make a zillion more dollars than you do, but this idea of making sure, and these were part of, this is part of the whole slow food thing too, of making sure that we keep in business those people who are producing food that the average person can afford to buy and can easily or maybe even with a little effort bring to their table. And that's the part of it. An example of this I'll just throw out. I belong to I'm actually on the board of an organization called the Chefs Collaborative. The Chefs mm-hmm. Collaborative in America are a group of chefs all around the country who came together originally because, number one, they recognize that chefs, restaurateurs, buy a lot of food. So you can have some influence on the kind of food that comes into your restaurant and maybe on the food world in a broader sense. And part of our charter, I guess, has been to really try to support what it's kind of become a buzzword, unfortunately, gotten a little bastardized, but sustainable food producers, whether organic or not, but people who are doing things in a very great way. Well, that's really fine. And, of course, restaurants, they thrive on having something special that the guy down the block doesn't have. So it's a little elitist often among restaurants, too. And I will tell you, and I'll just throw this out as maybe a jumping off point, when Walmart, of all people, which I thought was a great thing, when they announced that they were going to abide by the Monterey Bay Aquarium has a wonderful program called the Seafood Watch.
Yes, Seafood Watch. We've talked about it on here several times. So Walmart abides by Seafood Watch?
So they've made the commitment to not all of their seafood, but as much as they can and in an increasing amount in the future, that they are going to make sure that their seafoods are as sustainable as they can possibly do. And to me,
that's really good news.
A lot of my chef colleagues reacted to that is, oh, my God, isn't this awful? Because they're, of course, going to manipulate it and make it terrible and all of that stuff. And I looked at them and I said, you know, aren't these the victories that you want?
Yeah, they are.
So that idea that, and part of it was, of course, it talks to this kind of preciousness that a mm-hmm. lot of chefs feel about their ingredients too.
We have to be inclusive.
We do,
and
absolutely.
I think it's crucial to really our survival. And if we want the next generation to thrive, if we want humans to thrive, we have to be inclusive with this on every level. And we have, in this first Mouthful Salon, we have just a couple of minutes, if that, left. And you mentioned that restaurants need to do things to set themselves apart, to offer something. And really quickly, Joe, you told me something really interesting about restaurants in North Carolina. They're all steakhouses, but...
Basically, yeah, the high-end steakhouse. I mean, the high-end restaurants I was going to out there where I was looking to sell my wine at. And everything that seemed to be high-end was a steakhouse and then sushi bar or a steakhouse with some Cajun food or a steakhouse with, like, French food on the side.
Like all steak plus.
Yeah, it was a steakhouse to get, like, kind of like the regular sort of... you know, people from North Carolina and then something else to maybe try to lure them in with something else on that side. I always found that interesting.
That would be a really interesting thing
because
to
especially
investigate.
Especially comparing it to Northern California where you just don't have – I mean, there's a couple of steakhouses, but those – you know, the fine restaurants mm-hmm. in Northern California are basically anything but steakhouses.
Exactly.
And then they go there and the fine restaurants in North Carolina are steakhouses and it's hard to find anything but them.
And I sort of think of that as the Midwest and mm-hmm. the Chicago area. John, you have something there you want to say.
Oh, I was just thinking, I just happened to bring it along and it's a little thing about beef, you know, mm-hmm. about legitimacy of beef. And I think that they're, you know, I'm curious, did the steakhouses talk about sustainable, grass-fed, any of these other kinds of issues, or is it just to go and get a big old hunk of meat?
Oh, it's all about a big old hunk of meat. Yeah. It's like buying that gallon of milk at your local grocery store. Where does it come from? Is it hormone-free? What's in it? You know, there's all those other things, too. You know, it can go off in so many different directions.
And this conversation will, in part, go off in directions that you want it to. So if you have thoughts on this, anything related at all, we will address it here on Mouthful in our ongoing series of salons. And I think for starters, we're just going to make it our 07 salons and revisit this every week or close to every week with your participation. In the meantime, Joe Otis of Willowbrook Cellars and Owl Ridge Wines. You can check out Willowbrook Cellars at willowbrooksellars.com. Information for Owl Ridge is at owlridge.com. Sauvignon Republic has a website.
SauvignonRepublic.com. And actually, I have a website with all kinds of musings about all things. ChefJohnAsh.com.
Thanks so much to both of you for taking time. And thanks to you for tuning into Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Thanks as well to Lawrence Alberte, Mouthful engineer. See you next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Have a great week.
Local presentation of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour, is made possible in part by the Press Democrat, your local newspaper for over 148 years and 2004 winner of the George Polk Award. The Press Democrat, bringing you news that's important to your life. And from Tandem Winery, celebrating diversity in locally produced radio shows on KRCB, tandemwinery.com or 823-2794. And JAG Public Relations, providing comprehensive marketing communications, focusing on small and medium-sized businesses in wine, hospitality, and entertainment industries. JAG Public Relations will manage your web content, write copy, and fill your graphic design and still photography needs. More information available at 707-795-9400 or at jagpublicrelations.com.
Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my kitchen. Get out of my kitchen and let me cook.